2 meter band.
It is Wednesday, November 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley warns that the latest North Korean missile launch brings the world closer to war. Two more prominent public figures lose their jobs following accusations of sexual improprieties, and a small U.S. town rediscovers its amazing history. It's all ahead. U.S. Ambassador Nikki Haley had a warning Wednesday for North Korea following its latest intercontinental ballistic missile launch. She also called on U.N. member states to cut ties with Pyongyang, saying that all countries should sever diplomatic relations with North Korea and limit military, scientific, technical, or commercial cooperation. North Korea is claiming that the new intercontinental ballistic missile is proof that it now has a nuclear weapon that can reach any target in the United States. That, says the statement on North Korean media, shows that the country has reached its goal of achieving the greatest historic cause of completing the state nuclear force. Some are saying that could mean that the North might be willing now to resume negotiations. VOA's Ira Melman asked Evans Revere whether he agreed with that possibility. Revere is a former U.S. State Department official specializing in Asia.
Well, before we get to that, I would have to raise some questions about whether North Korea has in fact crossed the finish line in terms of developing the capability to actually strike the United States and targets anywhere in the United States with a nuclear weapon. The test that they conducted was very impressive in terms of its technical capability and the demonstration of this new capacity. And so it certainly has the range on paper to reach a number of targets in the United States, but there still are some serious technical hurdles that the North Koreans have yet to demonstrate that they have reached yet. One of those is whether that missile that was successfully tested yesterday could carry a nuclear warhead that entire distance, since a warhead is pretty heavy, and with the shielding and all of that, that would be one thing that we haven't seen yet demonstrated. But perhaps an even more fundamental thing that they have yet to prove is that they can send a warhead out into space and bring it back through the Earth's atmosphere and have the warhead successfully re-enter the Earth's atmosphere, survive all the forces, the heat and other forces, and then strike a target. So that those are two important things that the North Koreans have yet to demonstrate, and I have no doubt that in their next test or tests, and there will be more, they will be testing those capabilities, perhaps successfully. Now, when they do finally cross the finish line, it is entirely possible that they will respond to calls for talks by the United States or even propose them themselves. But if we get to that point, we will find very quickly that the kind of dialogue that the North Koreans are interested in having with the United States is not a dialogue about ending its nuclear program, but a dialogue that involves accepting them as a nuclear weapon state and dealing with them as such permanently. And that will be a very, very uncomfortable and probably unacceptable conversation for the United States.
You have taken part, as I understand it, in negotiations with the North Koreans. What is it that they want? You already said that they want to be a member of the nuclear family in the world, but what about it is, what do they crave most?
Well, I'll tell you what the North Koreans have told me and have told others in some of these conversations. They want to be accepted as a nuclear weapon state. They don't need to be formally acknowledged as such, they have told us. But they want to have their deterrent, and then they want to be able to enter into talks with the United States as one nuclear weapon state with another. Those are their words, and the words of a very, very senior North Korean official who said those things to us in one of our meetings with them. But beyond that, the North Koreans are hoping that once they develop and demonstrate authoritatively and credibly this new capability of being able to strike targets in the United States with a nuclear weapon, they then believe that they can compel the United States to come to the negotiating table and to negotiate with them as an equal a number of things of concern to the North Koreans, including ending the Korean War formally with a peace treaty that would replace the current armistice. Preferably, this would be a bilateral discussion that wouldn't involve the South Koreans, the ROK. And in the North Korean mind, that then leads to the end of the U.S.-South Korean alliance, the end of the U.S. military presence on the Korean Peninsula, the end of the U.S. nuclear umbrella over South Korea, as well as Japan. And this, at the end of the day, opens the door for them to then translate their nuclear monopoly on the Korean Peninsula into their ability to intimidate South Korea and forcibly, or preferably without any force, reunify the Korean Peninsula under Pyongyang.
What does this latest missile test do to at least some reports that there had been movement toward resumed negotiations? I don't know whether you were involved in any of these or not, but nevertheless, where do you think those movements do stand if indeed they did take place?
I have not seen any indications of any movement towards resumed negotiations, quite frankly. I've seen a lot of aspirational statements. I've seen a lot of expressions of hope, particularly on the part of people in the current administration, particularly in the State Department. To be clear, Secretary Tillerson has made, since August of this year, a couple of references to the possibility that an extended moratorium by North Korea on nuclear and missile tests would lead to some positive developments. We have seen those statements followed up by, in the case of the August statements, an unprecedentedly large thermonuclear test by North Korea and an ICBM test, and in response to his repetition of this 60-day clock or suspension or moratorium idea in recent weeks, we've now seen an unprecedentedly successful test of a new type of North Korean ICBM. So it seems pretty clear to me that while there may have been some hopes for a resumption of talks and some hope for signals, etc., the reality is that the North Koreans have continued with the development of their nuclear weapons program and missile programs apace. There's been no delay that I've seen.
That's former U.S. State Department official Evans Revere. He was speaking with VOA's Ira Melman. Time now for social media. Well, one of the biggest news stories of the day is the firing of longtime Today Show host Matt Lauer by NBC News. NBC News Chairman Andy Lack said in a statement on Monday night, "We received a detailed complaint from a colleague about inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace by Matt Lauer. It represented, after serious review, a clear violation of our company's standards. As a result," he said, "we've decided to terminate Lauer's employment." Lauer has worked at the network for more than 20 years. One of the first to comment on this was President Donald Trump. "Wow," he said, "Matt Lauer was just fired from NBC for inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace. But when will the top executives at NBC and Comcast be fired for putting out so much fake news? Check out Andy Lack's past." We'll have more on this story later in the program. But as well, President Trump retweeted three inflammatory anti-Muslim videos that were posted on Twitter by a far-right British politician, sparking widespread condemnation, repudiation, and fears of a backlash against Muslim Americans. The videos, one of which incorrectly identified an attacker as a Muslim, first appeared on the Twitter account of Jada Franson, deputy head of the anti-immigrant Britain First Party. A White House spokesman said he did not know how Trump had found the videos online, but one of them had previously been retweeted by a conservative talk show host that the president admires. And that's a look at social media. here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A new report says the Muslim population in Europe is projected to rise, whether there's more migration or not. Nigerian President Buhari vows to bring back stranded citizens in Libya and elsewhere. A top U.S. general says Pakistan is yet to act against the Afghan Taliban. And in South Sudan, Boma youth are accused of killing dozens in Jonglei State. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOAnews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scottish researchers think life on Earth may have originated from biological particles that were sent in high-speed streams of interplanetary space dust. Similar flows of possible life-laden dust may also be traveling from our planet to others in the solar system. The new study from scientists from the University of Edinburgh proposes that dust streams with possible alien organisms could collide with biological particles in Earth's atmosphere with enough energy to knock them into space, send them traveling to other worlds in our solar system or perhaps in others. The researchers say their new findings suggest that large asteroid impacts may not be the only way that life-giving material can transfer between planets, as was previously thought. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Hollywood's long-awaited movie museum will open in 2019. Two major American broadcasters, as we heard, were abruptly fired Wednesday over allegations of sexual misconduct. NBC's Matt Lauer and Public Radio's Garrison Keillor are the latest famous figures to either lose their jobs or fight for their political and professional survival because of alleged inappropriate behavior toward women. The list includes President Donald Trump, former President Bill Clinton when he was in office in the 1990s, actor Bill Cosby, film producer Harvey Weinstein, journalists, and corporate executives. About 16 women have accused Trump of sexual harassment or worse. He's labeled the accusations fake news in both online tweets and other statements. Meg Bond is the director of the Center for Women and Work at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. She tells me her reaction to the recent firings involving Matt Lauer and CBS and PBS journalist Charlie Rose.
What's really surprising is just that it's starting to spill out. What's not surprising is exactly what you said. This has been going on for a very long time, and in fact, probably the majority of women, research shows that the majority of women have experienced something in the form of sexual harassment throughout their work lives. So to have it finally come to light is really the change that has emerged, not the fact that this has been going on.
Well, it was the most recent case involved Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. That seemed, in a way, to launch a lot of this, although I guess you could also say the charges in the court case involving comedian Bill Cosby also got a lot of people to look at this issue.
Yes, and the Weinstein case really seemed to unleash the reports that have come out, the kinds of things that have emerged in social media, but I think it's been in the air for a while, and I think we can also link it back to a lot of what happened during the presidential campaign in terms of the kinds of sexist comments and beliefs and the accusations against our president brought out that this behavior has been going on for a long time, a lot of men in power, and that it's been tolerated, and I think there's a level of frustration that probably has been brewing, and it just needed that tipping point to see that there was a way to come forward, and that social media has provided something that we never had before in terms of a place where it's become safe through the Me Too campaign and through the high-profile cases that are now getting taken seriously by organizational leaders and industry leaders who are willing to take some kind of action.
Certainly, looking back at the presidential campaign, there was that Access Hollywood tape of now President Trump. This was a number of years ago. He wasn't president then, but he was speaking, and he made inappropriate highly inappropriate comments about women. But there was also during the campaign, Trump brought out three women who have had accused in the past of former President Bill Clinton of sexual impropriety as well. So this very much goes to, it's both political parties.
Oh, absolutely. And this kind of behavior, really, it has its roots in deep societal values about women, and those do not line up along party lines. That we have a deep socialization around how women are valued in our society and what their appropriate roles are, and a lot of it has focused on women as objects and available to men as sexual beings versus thinking about women as and treating women as competent people, valued for their skills and expertise. So the problems run very, very deep, and really if we want to shift this, we're probably talking about the need to socialize our children in a different way around gender roles and attitudes towards women. And that depth of the problem means that this is not a simple political issue or that it lines up along any kinds of party lines. It's a broad-based issue. So if you look at the research, it's kind of interesting because some folks focus on reports of sexual harassment, but we know from research that, well, some of the studies say 70%, others say 90% of women who've experienced sexual harassment never report it, never even talk to a supervisor, much less report it in some kind of formal way. So this has been a broad-based problem experienced by women across class, across race, ethnicity, for a very long time. And it simply hasn't had the receptivity or the sense that at least some women are feeling safe coming out, and that's what's new.
Well, and I think in this latest case of Matt Lauer, apparently there have been some investigations going on by the New York Times and I guess Variety magazine were looking into this anyway. And certainly the New York Times.
The media has been incredibly important in giving voice to women who haven't been believed before, who've been dismissed, who've been either subtly or even more blatantly marginalized whenever they raise a concern. I applaud the press for what they've done to make it okay and at least safe for some people. I mean, I think there are a lot of people, women, who still don't feel safe raising their concerns because they're worried about not being believed, they're worried about the backlash, they're worried about being ostracized. But the media has played a tremendously helpful role in allowing women's voices to be heard, and I'm very grateful to the press for taking this issue so seriously.
That's Meg Bond. She's the director of the Center for Women and Work at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell. Well, visitors to Los Angeles can tour movie studios and other Hollywood venues, but the city has never had a museum devoted to the movies. But the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is sponsoring a museum now under construction that will celebrate the city's most famous industry. More from VOA's Mike O'Sullivan.
Tourists to Los Angeles usually visit Hollywood, the historic home of the movies and movie stars.
Welcome to Hollywood. You have arrived.
They can visit the Dolby Theater, where the Oscars are presented. Not far from here, a massive complex will fill a major gap for both residents and tourists. Donors and studio executives toured the site of the future museum, first suggested by stars Douglas Fairbanks, Mary Pickford, and other Hollywood luminaries in the 1920s.
And it just didn't happen for one reason or another. And finally, here we are. We're in the middle of it right now. It's being built around us, and it will open up in 2019, and Los Angeles will have the museum it finally deserves.
The $388 million complex will feature a 1,000-seat theater and immersive exhibits on topics from movie makeup to changing cinema technology, and costume items from classic films like The Wizard of Oz.
As you're moving through it, it'll be like a journey. You won't necessarily know what's coming next or what's around the next corner, and you'll be in environments sometimes that makes you feel like you've gone back to the past, that you're in the era that you're actually exploring.
The museum will fill a gap for tourists.
And I think they wander around wondering where they can experience this great golden, ticket in some ways to the movies. Now they'll have a place.
And it will fill a need for those in the movie business, highlighting the city's iconic industry. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Sounds interesting. I'd like to visit someday. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. A dedicated teacher and her students are discovering that their small hometown of Cheltenham, Pennsylvania, played a surprisingly large role in U.S. history. Over the centuries, it was a refuge for a religious minority, a training ground for an army that fought against slavery, and home to a financier who raised huge sums to pay for the Civil War. Jan Sluzer reports Cheltenham's story was a surprise to people who spent all their lives in the community and graduated from Cheltenham High School.
Teacher Lisa Marlowe grew up in Cheltenham, graduated from Cheltenham High, and taught in a local school for 10 years before she learned about Cheltenham's 335-year-long history.
Never heard of Camp William Penn. Never heard of African-American soldiers training here. I never heard that Lucretia Mott was this famous abolitionist lady who lived here. I wasn't taught that Frederick Douglass was here, that Harry Tubman was here, that William Steele was here, William Lloyd Garrison, Robert Purvis. And here I am teaching social studies.
Marlowe introduced this unknown history to her students. Together, they wrote a book called Back in Time with Cheltenham and made a movie. When Cheltenham High School's class of 1967 held its 50th reunion, Marlowe took alumni on a tour of places where they grew up, starting with the Richard Wall House. Wall left Cheltenham, England, with Quakers in 1682, seeking religious freedom in the American colony of Pennsylvania. He named their new settlement Cheltenham after their old town. Wall's home soon became a Quaker meeting house.
The coolest thing about the Wall House is that it's one of the very first places in the nation where they talked about ending slavery in 1688.
Almost two centuries later, during the Civil War, Cheltenham took another step against slavery. Nearby Philadelphia's large African-American population made it a logical place to train segregated units for the Union Army. But Philadelphia was also home to many Southern sympathizers, and city officials worried there'd be riots.
They wanted to move it outside of Philadelphia. So who's that? That's us, right? Cheltenham Avenue, right, is the border of Philadelphia and Cheltenham. So all that land on the other side of Cheltenham Avenue was Lucretia Mott's land. Now, we know she was a Quaker, very against war, but she understood why black men wanted to fight and end slavery.
Mott was a leader in the anti-slavery movement, so she leased her land to the federal government for $1, and Camp William Penn was built there.
11,000 men trained here. 40% were slaves. They were sent to find Abraham Lincoln's assassins. They were at the surrender of Lee in Virginia. They were the only black troops to carry Lincoln's casket when he was killed. And when you read a Civil War book, could be 2,000 pages long, there is no mention of them. They were 12% of the army.
America's first investment banker, Jay Cook, built his mansion in Cheltenham, not far from Camp William Penn, and his good friend, Lucretia Mott. On January 1, 1861, a few months before the start of the Civil War, Cook opened a private banking house in Philadelphia and soon became involved in selling bonds to finance the Pennsylvania militia. He was so successful, the federal government asked him to sell bonds for the Union Army. Jay Cook is known as the financier of the Civil War.
General Grant, who came here to Cheltenham, said that the Civil War would never have been won without Jay Cook. He raised over $1 billion worth of U.S. war bonds. It was his idea to create war bonds to finance the war.
In the modern era, Cheltenham High School produced some well-known names. Baseball great Reggie Jackson was in the class of 1964, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu graduated in 1967, although he didn't make the 50th reunion. Everyone who did knew about those alumni, but until they took Lisa Marlowe's tour, no one knew anything about the history of the place where they grew up. Alumni Alan Monheit sees the old neighborhood with new eyes.
I didn't appreciate all these things we have right in our backyard. To learn about the history of Lucretia Mott, that we saw that, I mean, we're just probably scratching the surface. Such a gorgeous area, the history about the abolition and the Civil War. Just fascinating. I didn't really know any of this.
December 6 marks the anniversary of the 1865 ratification of the U.S. Constitution's 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. Thanks to Lisa Marlowe, many now know the role some of Cheltenham's leading residents played in making that happen. For VOA News, this is Jan Sluzer in Cheltenham, Pennsylvania.
That is our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Robert Mugabe resigned the presidency of Zimbabwe last week after Parliament initiated impeachment proceedings against him, ending his oppressive 37-year rule and opening the country to what U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called an extraordinary opportunity to set itself on a new path. Mugabe was elected as Zimbabwe's first prime minister in 1980 and became president in 1987 after changes to the constitution created an executive presidency. He had remained in power ever since. During his rule, the United States condemned his government's increasing assault on human rights and the rule of law and joined much of the world in calling for the government of Zimbabwe to embrace a peaceful democratic evolution. In his place, former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa was sworn in, promising the beginning of a new unfolding democracy. With the resignation of Robert Mugabe, today marks a historic moment for Zimbabwe, said Secretary Tillerson in a statement. We congratulate all Zimbabweans who raised their voices and stated peacefully and clearly that the time for change was overdue. The United States looks forward to and hopes for free and fair elections, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert.
The people of Zimbabwe have firmly voiced their desire for a new era to bring an end to Zimbabwe's isolation and allow the country to rejoin the international community. The future of Zimbabwe, though, has to be determined by the people of that country.
Secretary Tillerson also said, we urge Zimbabwe's leaders to implement much-needed political and economic reforms for a more stable and promising future for the Zimbabwean people. We will continue to support the people of Zimbabwe as these reforms move forward. U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe Harry Thomas noted future U.S. engagement with Zimbabwe and President Mnangagwa will depend on those actions. This is a new day. This is a new opportunity for him and his cabinet to live up to the wonderful 2013 Zimbabwean Constitution. And that is what we will tell them. It is your constitution. It is democratic. It is something you endorsed when you were Minister of Justice and later as Vice President. This is for your people. So live up to it, and the United States will find a way to partner. The United States is the largest provider of development and humanitarian assistance to the people of Zimbabwe, providing $253 million last year. The United States, said Secretary Tillerson, strongly supports a peaceful, democratic, and prosperous Zimbabwe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.